Hello, and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we take on the issues of race, gender, and social justice. I'm your host, Omkare Williams, and I'm very glad you're here with me today. Hosting this podcast means that I'm privileged to speak with people who are out in the world, making a difference with their day jobs, their programs, their art, their activism. And I love doing this. If you would like to support me in doing this work, you can do so for as little as $3 a month by becoming a member of my Patreon community. You can go to patreon.com/OmkareWilliams and sign up. There's also a link on my website, omkarewilliams.com. My guest today is Dr. Manuel Pastor. Dr. Pastor is the director of the Equity Research Institute at USC. He is also the author of State of Resistance, What California's Dizzying Descent and Remarkable Resurgence Mean for America's Future. In this book, he weaves together data and stories about the economic inequality, racial divides, and immigrant-influenced demographic changes that took an anti-immigrant, conservative California down. His expertise comes from a decades-long career analyzing California's demographic changes and the multiracial movement organizing that transformed its once anti-immigrant attitude to the inclusive, progressive state we know today. As the rest of the country follows a similar path of becoming more diverse, Dr. Pastor believes California's story can serve as a roadmap for the nation. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Pastor to the podcast. Hi, Manuel. How are you?
I'm good. So good to be with you today.
Thank you so much. So to start this conversation, because your book is absolutely fascinating, I want to go back in time a little bit. And I think that most people, when they think of California, they think of it as this very progressive, very blue state. But that's not what it looked like as recently as 30 or so years ago. California gave us Rush Limbaugh, it gave us Ronald Reagan, and their impact on the current state of affairs that we find ourselves in right now is undeniable. And I would love for you to set the stage for us of where California was and how the shift to where it is now began.
Yeah, I mean, people do forget that the so-called left coast actually also gave you Richard Nixon and anti-immigrant hysteria and the first kind of tax revolt that led to the idea of starving the government from the resources that it needed, or that Los Angeles in the early 20th century was called the Wicked City, and not because it was, like Las Vegas, a place where you could sin, but because it was so anti-labor in its orientation, even though now it's been the location for the rebirth of the labor movement in the United States, particularly in immigrant and service industries. So in particular, in the early 1990s, what we saw in California was a state deeply battered by the recession and also racked by racial inequality. So people forget that in the early 1990s, that recession was actually caused by a cutback in defense spending due to the end of the Cold War that had tremendous impacts on California's economy, which was highly reliant on aerospace and technology. And as a result, nearly half of the job losses suffered in the early 1990s occurred at a national level, actually occurred in California. It's also the case that California in the 90s, as these economic problems were going on, wound up scapegoating immigrants and people of color as being responsible for those problems. So in 1994, California voters actually voted for a thing called Proposition 187, which sought to strip social services and indeed even education from undocumented immigrants in the state. And as you pointed out, Rush Limbaugh began his talk radio career in Sacramento in the late 1980s. And a lot of the hate radio that has become so prevalent today was actually perfected in Los Angeles in the early 1990s. So that kind of stew of economic dislocation, racial anxiety around changing demographics, and profiteering off of political polarization, that's where California was in the 1990s, very much like where America has been at during the era of Trump.
Yeah. And one of the things that really struck me is you do draw a real direct cause and effect line between a number of decisions that were taken in California over the years that not only led to it being in crisis, and on, you know, fronts as varied as fiscal, educational, and racial, to name just a few, but that also have resonance for the circumstance that we're in as a country right now. You mentioned Proposition 187, and also Proposition 13 is something that I think has a resonance for this particular moment in time. Would you talk about Prop 13 and the impact that it had and the connection you see between both Prop 187 and Prop 13 to our current challenges?
Yeah, you know, I would step back too and say that it's important to understand that what we try to do in the book is to talk about the rise, the fall, and then the sort of resurgence or renewal of California. The rise is really important too. You know, in the 50s and in the 60s, and it was imperfect because there was still racial segregation in housing, in labor markets, et cetera, but the state was investing in the expansion of its infrastructure, mostly roads and dams at that point. It was also investing in human capital, expanding education, both at a primary level and at the university level. And it was generating an economy that created jobs that were in the middle in terms of their wages that were working class jobs. I mean, I know this story personally. My family moved to California in the 1950s, actually for kind of a funny reason. My sister had asthma and the doctors said we were in New York, that moving to Los Angeles would be good for your asthma. They apparently didn't understand smog very much at that time.
Apparently anyway,
not. Despite the ways in which both African-Americans and Latinos were barred from most opportunities that were there, we, you know, my dad was able to get a unionized job and our family was able to be moved from being poor to being working class. My family was able to buy a house in a very diverse suburb, lots of African-American Latinos and whites living in that area. I was able to go to public schools because we were investing in them. And when it came time to go to the university, there was affirmative action to take a chance on a kid like me who did not fit the typical profile. So California's rise was its sense of investing in itself and in its next generation, and a kind of compact of welcoming and understanding that we need public platforms and public investment to be successful. But as early as the 1960s, you began to see white Californians essentially becoming nervous about the demographic change that was occurring in the state of California and wanting to lift up the drawbridges. In the 1960s, white voters voted for a Proposition 14. It's got a little bit less of a history than 13, but it was critical because it tried to reinstitute the ability to segregate in housing and not sell your house to an African-American or Latino if you wanted to, because white owners were freaked out about the demographic change. And Proposition 13 that passed in 1978 was a proposition that took property taxes in the state, took the property values, rolled them back several years, and then limited whether or not you could increase the assessments over time. Essentially, what that did was lock in low tax burdens for incumbent white homeowners, just at the time that there were more diverse homeowners beginning to get into the market, and just at the time that the state was changing in a way that we needed more investments in public education, particularly for kids of color. So 1978, Prop 13 passes. The 1970s is the decade in California in which the share of children who are children of color grows by more than at any other time in California's history before or since. So just at the time that the education system is becoming much more children of color, older white homeowners are saying, we don't want to pay taxes to support that system. The reason why this is important is if you look at how that then wound up shortchanging our general ability to invest in infrastructure, invest in education, invest in human capital, and create a social compact, the key Achilles heel for California was racism. That is, that when people got so distracted by racism that they shut off the fiscal coffers that we needed to invest with Prop 13, that they began to attack immigrants with Proposition 187, when they began to eliminate affirmative action as a way of saying we need to hold on to opportunities for white folks rather than to include everyone. When they passed three strikes laws that they knew were going to criminalize particularly Black youth, but also Latino youth as well, all of that was flowing out of racism. And all of that was a distraction from dealing with the underlying economic problems that we had in terms of the deindustrialization from the cutback from defense spending, the need to reboot our economy, the need to deal with working poverty, the need to invest in the next generation for a skilled workforce that could succeed going into the future. And that is another parallel for the United States as well, which is that what the Trump era did was recognize a serious problem in terms of people feeling left out economically. Of course, some elements of the white working class, but of course, Black and Latino workers as well. That was a real problem. And instead of dealing with it, racism was used to blame immigrants and to distract people from what the economic agenda became, which was passing big, gigantic tax cuts for rich people, which, by the way, is how Proposition 13 played out as well. Because if you think about it, people who were got the biggest properties got these huge values of savings from not being assessed at full market value. And it turns out corporations benefited disproportionately from Proposition 13. So the parallels are eerie, and it's one of the reasons why the first chapter in the book is called America Fast Forward, because we think that the tale of California has a lot of cautionary lessons and perhaps progressive lessons in terms of what to do for America itself.
I absolutely think so. As I was reading the book, I thought, oh yeah, California was absolutely a bellwether for where we find ourselves now. Certainly when you look at Trump supporters at the MAGA crowd, the browning of America is a key part of the strife that engages them and got them to the polls and has encouraged them and led to the insurrection on January 6th. And it's really interesting to me as I was reading the book with January 6th in my mind to notice how part of the structure that happened, and I don't know whether this was particularly well thought out on the part of the right in California, but the way that they manipulated lower income white people to be more involved with their whiteness than their economic well-being was fascinating for me to just think about all of that. Because it seems like there should be a natural alliance between those people on the lower end of the economic spectrum who are white and immigrants, African Americans, and so on. Yet that's not what happened.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we do in the book is point to what we call the racial generation gap, which is the share of people above the age of 65 seniors who are white compared to the share of kids, people under the age of 18, who are kids of color. And what we show is that that racial generation gap peaked in California in the early 1990s, this period of Proposition 187, elimination of affirmative action, elimination of bilingual education, and criminalization of Black and brown youth. And that racial generation gap in the nation is peaking right now in terms of the Trump era. So I think what happens, you're right, is that white people see that change. It's an uncomfortable change for some folks. And because it is, they turn to a kind of tribalism, and in that tribalism can be distracted from what might be the actual investments that could be necessary for making people be able all to succeed economically, which is going to take the ability of communities to come together. So I think that's a really important set of observations that you're making. And I think that the thing that we need to be clear about, and I think this was pretty clear in California, sometimes when that observation is being made, this is not the way you're making it. People say that because there's so much common interest, we must focus in on the class or economic issues, and that's how we build a coalition. I think the lesson from California is you need to put race central into the conversation, both because that will help people think about what is being used to distract them, but also so that you mobilize people of color who are natural constituents who can understand that they are being seen in an alternative economic vision around what kind of investments to make. So I think when we think about race and class, I think you remember when Trump got elected and there were all those debates about, well, is this about race or is this about class? Is this about demographic anxiety or is this about economic uncertainty? I used to say at the time, and I would still say, you can only have that debate if you believe you cannot hold two ideas in your head at the same time. If you can hold two ideas in your head at the same time, you understand that it's both about race and it's about class, and that we need to have a full-throated economic program that can benefit everyone. And we need to be constantly talking about and bringing into the conversation, not just race, because race is about who we are, how we grew up, what our culture is, but about racism, about the structures that prevent people from being able to realize their fullest possibilities.
Something you said that I think is really important, and you sort of touched on it briefly here, is a narrative, having a convincing economic narrative. And you say that progressives need to have a convincing economic narrative to tell their constituents about their goals in the area of economics. What is it that you think progressives need to be saying that you are not hearing enough of yet?
Well, looping back to some of the stories from California, but I think these are national stories as well. Narrative is incredibly important at doing something really key, which is moving the middle rather than moving to the middle. That is trying to drag the conversation in the direction of justice rather than trying to figure out how to settle in a quote unquote bipartisan way. And I feel like narrative is incredibly important for that. So for example, the Dreamers, by embracing the language of the dream, which is like the American dream, were able to move the debate to a point where almost no one says that young kids brought to this country when they were young or undocumented and basically grew up here shouldn't find some kind of path. It still remains, you know, a problem to get through the Senate and the House, but I think the narrative battle's been won. When you think about marriage equality sort of shifted the debate into, well, yeah, everybody has the right to love who they want. And it really, I think, moved things. I think when you think about the success of the Black Lives Matter movement, part of it is great organizing and tactics, et cetera. I actually think a lot of it had to do with the fact that that's a very simple value statement, Black Lives Matter. And that to go up against that statement, you have to say that they don't. And once you make it Black Lives Matter around policing, then you understand, well, Black lives must matter also around where we're putting our educational investments, whether or not we're cleaning up the environment in communities of color, whether or not we're really respecting Black lives in their full totality. I think we need that around the economy. I think that too often when we talk about the economy, it's more like, well, this is really unfair. We need to tax the rich. But we don't develop a kind of language about the economy that points in a very different direction and moves the middle. Let me give you an example of something that is doing exactly that. All of the language around the care economy, which is understanding that a lot of our economy is about care. It's about taking care of elders. It's about taking care of the young. It's about taking care of all of us when we are sick. And by the way, that's been driven home to us in the context of the COVID crisis, right? Where so many people have been pulled away from the labor market because there's not a sufficient daycare system in the country to be able to take care of children under these circumstances. When we are worried about the sick, and I think in this current COVID crisis, this sort of language of mutuality and solidarity has been really critical. I'll just give you a couple of examples of this. We know that in the midst of a public health crisis, that you wear that mask to protect yourself, but you wear it to protect everyone else as well. And even if you're vaccinated, you wear it because it's a signal to everybody else, don't get nervous. I'm not going to communicate this disease to you because I've got my mask on, et cetera. So we've learned a lot of lessons from that. And one thing we've learned, I think dramatically, that I'd like to lift up, that I think loops back to this really, really importantly, is the difference between equality and equity. Now, let's think about the vaccine rollout as an example of this. You know, the vaccine rollout in most states has been, quote unquote, pretty equal. If you were in the right age category and in the right occupation category, you had first shot at a shot. And you were able to get it, provided that you had high-speed internet, a computer or a laptop, the technological sophistication to put an automatic refresher on your browser, the kind of job where you could take 3 or 4 hours off in the middle of the day anytime you wanted, once an appointment opened up, and a car to get to one of those mega sites that's easily at your disposal. Totally equal, completely inequitable, because everybody that's on the wrong side of the digital divide, that's on the wrong side of employment quality, that's on the wrong side of transit independence, they're reliant on public transit to take them someplace, is disadvantaged. And when you do that, you don't get at where the disease really is. And if you don't get at where the disease really is, it's going to pop up not just in communities of color, low-income communities, but in the places that they work and threaten everyone. And so, particularly here in California, after recognizing those problems, there's been a real shift to community clinics, mobile clinics. I know that's happening where you are too. And also, we've put requirements on that until the vaccines have been sufficiently going to communities that are in the lowest quartile, something called the California Place Healthy Places Index, that until we meet those goals, you can't reopen. And all of a sudden, everybody's got an economic incentive to flood communities of color, low-income communities, where there really are the COVID problems, right? With lots of vaccines, because everybody's interests are aligned around solidarity and equity as being key to reopening our economy. That's what we need. We need a language about why solidarity and mutuality is the best thing for our economy. And in fact, in many ways it is. You know, we've done a lot of research looking at the rate of employment growth in metropolitan regions in the United States. And those regions that are the most equal, the least residentially segregated, and the least fragmented politically, actually are able to sustain employment growth more than regions that are unequal, racially segregated, and politically fragmented. We tend to think, because of the capture of neoliberal market ideology, that individualism is what will help make an economy work. You know from the last year that individualism, your refusal to put on a mask, your refusal to coordinate with other people, is what will sink the economy. And that's an important lesson, not just in a pandemic, but in our regular world as we emerge. Unless we invest in public schools for this next generation of kids of color, we're not going to have a workforce that's going to make sure that we've got a sufficiently productive economy going forward. If we continue to over-criminalize, particularly Black communities, and lose so many people to the incarceration system who then have real difficulties jumping back into the labor market, think about how much talent you're losing. And if you continue to freeze people out from being able to realize their most potential, either because of sexism or because they don't have legal status to be able to start a business, really secure good work, et cetera, think how much economic, how many dollars are being wasted on the floor. We need to have a different kind of economic narrative that doesn't look at equity as a cost to prosperity, but equity as central to realizing our prosperity.
I love that, because I do think that that's a mind shift that needs to happen and that we don't address often enough. I mean, in the classes that I teach on activism, I always center the importance, no matter what one's particular activist focus is, of dealing with racism, particularly anti-Black racism in that activist work. And you put it this way in your book. You wrote that systemic racism has created a sinkhole that prevents us from addressing our big economic and generational challenges. And I think that that is something that we really need to grapple with, because if we don't address that, then nothing else is going to be able to come forward that will basically lift all boats, you know? So when you think about how we might fill that sinkhole, what is it that you would like us to be putting our attention on?
Well, a couple of things. One is, I think that it's really crucial as we fill that sinkhole to have conversations about race and racism that are frank, open, honest, soul-searching, et cetera. You know, there's an example I often use, particularly when I get a chance to talk to a big audience, which of course is not as frequent these days, although it's Zooming and it's kind of like hard to figure out how people are reacting. But I often will say, well, how many people go to the gym? And, you know, hands raise, some hands go up sheepishly because people go to the gym just every once in a while. And I say, well, you know, if you go to the gym every once in a while, bad, isn't it? I mean, you know, it hurts, you make mistakes, you drop weights on your foot. Nobody in the gym actually probably really wants to help you because they're realizing that you're here in January, but you're not going to be there in July. So since you're not there for the long haul, they're not really going to step in and teach you how to use the machines, right? And that's a little bit like not talking about race and racism every day. If you don't do it, you won't get good at it. If you do it, you get better. If you do it, even when you make mistakes and say something awkward or wrong, people will call you in versus calling you out because they understand that you're in it for the conversation and you will develop your skills to be able to talk about that. So one thing I think is talking about race and racism on a consistent level. And I'm really glad to hear that you do that in your classes and with your students, no matter what the realm of activism that we're talking about, environmental or labor, et cetera. The second thing I think that is really critical, and I think is kind of related to it, is what I would call acting as though the other is in the room. So when you're in a conversation, in my particular case, where it's a lot of folks who are oriented around immigrant rights, I'm Latino, did a lot of work around immigrants because that's something I study and it's part of my family history. And when you're in one of those rooms and someone says something that's anti-Black, you got to call it out. You got to talk about why the contours of anti-Black racism have set the sort of scaffold for xenophobia that affects immigrant lives and why it is that the racialization of immigrants is emerging from the depth of anti-Black racism in the United States, even as we acknowledge the specific situation of Asian Americans, for example, who were the first racial group actually excluded from the United States, et cetera. Similarly, if you're in a group of people that's all Black and someone starts saying stuff about immigrants taking jobs, it's really crucial to talk about the fact that immigrants don't own those jobs. They're not the ones who are making the decisions, and that we can actually make a lot more progress if we understand each other's stories. I mean, I always think about Isabel Wilkerson's Warmth of Other Suns book, where she's really telling the story of the Great Migration. But if you really read that book carefully, at least through my eyes, you know, about every 50 pages, she kind of winks at you and says, you know what? That's a lot like immigrants today. And what she's trying to do is to tell the story of Black Americans through the Great Migration and tell its story on its own, but also link it in a way that will create some empathy from those who are reading it for the stories of immigrants today. So speaking as though the other isn't in the room. We would always like to organize in a place where the full diversity of our communities is reflected in the organizing tables. But we also understand that there needs to be Black-only spaces, Indigenous folks-only spaces, Latino-only or immigrant-only, Asian-only spaces, even white-only spaces to deal with issues of whiteness, et cetera. And in those spaces, are you speaking up for the other? I think those are some important things that I like to carry around in my practice in terms of filling the hole. The last thing is something we already mentioned. Once people have dealt with that, you've got to offer them an economic program that says, if we make these investments, our economy will generate the employment and business, because people love small businesses too, business opportunities that will allow people to thrive.
Yeah, I think that's something that's really enormously important in activism, in organizing, is to not only look at the things that you're trying to correct, but also the things that you are for. So the things that will allow someone to thrive, not just the things that take an onerous burden off someone. And I know that this comes up in your book many times, is the notion of not just what are you opposed to, but what do you stand for? So would you talk about why you feel that this is a really critical part of effective organizing?
What a great question. And for the podcast listeners, I've got to say that it's wonderful to be interviewed by Omkari, but I also kind of want to ask her a lot of questions, but I'm in the about her and her work and that kind of thing as well. You know, I just give you a little story background. It's kind of buried in the book, but I talk about a group in the late 1980s that I helped to form called the New Majority Task Force. It brought together African-Americans, Latinos, and Asian Pacific Islanders in Los Angeles to think about an economic program that would unite those three communities and progressive whites. And it was just at the time that the city of Los Angeles was crossing the threshold into becoming majority people of color. And the title New Majority was designed pretty specifically because, number one, for that set of groups to collaborate, they needed to be intersectional and understand each other's stories and issues, similarities, and differences. But the second was the rejection of the word minority. And it's a word I never use. I mean, I use people of color, et cetera, but I don't use minorities. And I don't because when you're a minority, you react. When you're a majority, you propose. And I think that all of us should be proposing. We should be saying what we want the world to look like. And we should be offering people an example of what that world could look like. Because I think, you know, in the United States, we're eminently practical. So if you critique or criticize something, but you don't really have an alternative, people are like, well, that you know, that's great that you don't like Amazon. How do you expect goods to get to our house, right? So unless you are able to say, you know, I am really concerned about gentrification. And have you heard about community land trusts where you actually buy the land so that you don't actually see the land go up in value and you build the housing there? I am really concerned about labor exploitation. Have you heard about raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour? I am really concerned about environmental injustice. Why don't we create green zones where we say there's a priority in these communities that are overburdened and socially vulnerable, where we're going to prioritize the investments so that we make sure that those communities can clean up and green up on an accelerated basis and get the benefits of the new green economy. I am really concerned about over-policing, and I think that we should defund the police. Here's what I think community safety looks like. Here's how we get gang intervention folks, mental health workers, social workers into our communities to actually generate the kind of safety that people take for granted in higher income communities. We're an eminently practical people, Americans, as we say in Spanish, los estadounidenses, the United Statesians. We are eminently practical, and people want to know that there's a difference that can be made if they take action. There's another thing there that I think is really important, Omkari, which is that we also need to produce wins along the way. So while it's important to say, you know, what we want is a really much more just society. For example, in Los Angeles County, this last year, we passed something called Measure J. What it does is it takes 10% of county discretionary funds, and it says that they must be spent on social service, mental health stuff in local communities. You know what? It in effect is defunding the sheriff's department because that's where the money is going to come from. But it actually proposed something different. Is it really completely eliminating their budget? No. Is it enough money? No. But we won something. People feel empowered and they're ready to go to the next thing. So I think it's really important to realize, for example, that California has something called the California Values Act, which basically, what a great act. It says that California values are such that no police department or sheriff department should cooperate with immigration and customs enforcement, because that's our California values. You could think that that came out of nowhere, but it didn't. It came out of fights for a California Dream Act to make sure that there'd be resources for dreamers in the state to be able to go to college. It came out of a fight to make sure that there would be driver's licenses for undocumented residents in the state of California to be able to drive. These stepping stones, these little wins, build the confidence for people to get bigger wins. Before there was a $15 an hour minimum wage at a state level, there were $15 hour minimum wage in Los Angeles and in certain places in the Bay Area. And before that, there was a campaign for a living wage with regard to subcontracts. So we need to win so that we can convince people that we can actually make a better world.
Yeah, I really quite like that because I think that it's important for people to have that emotional connection to a victory so that they can see that progress is possible. Because otherwise, because this is a long game, it can be very easy to get discouraged. And that actually brings me to something that I wanted to ask you about, because I know that you think it is enormously important that we have community organizers as the driving force in our activist work, and that those organizations, those various organizations, work together. And I would love for you to talk about that, because it has such major implications for the United States, what California was able to do to navigate its turnaround in terms of bringing those organizers together and having them stop being siloed in their different causes. So if you could talk about how that really made a difference and the implications it has for us as a country.
Yeah, well, I think when you think about the arc of California from the early 1990s and all of those, what one author, Daniel Hosing, called racial propositions, and then you get to the current period, you know, it's easy for people to say, well, you know, we've got different political leaders, like a Jerry Brown came back, and that's really why the state turned around. And, you know, it's easy to point to other sorts of things. What we try to do in the book is to uncover a subterranean history that's really critical, which is the shift in community organizing. Because a lot of the stuff that even Jerry Brown takes credit for actually came from community organizers. He actually passed or helped to pass the first proposition that began to repair the fiscal holes created by Prop 13. But it wasn't his idea. He actually was proposing a massive increase in the sales tax, and community organizers and social movement activists were promoting a millionaire's tax led by a former Black Panther Party member. And they basically forced him to compromise and create a fiscal measure that was more reliant on the millionaire's tax than it was on the sales tax. When you think about the way in which we've done climate change and paid some degree of attention to environmental justice, that's the result of organizers and not politicians. And even when you think about the statewide increase in the minimum wage, when Brown navigated that, it was partly because he was afraid that labor and community organizers were going to be able to pass something even more severe than what he wound up agreeing to. So the start, you know, the press is such a good example. I mean, the press like doesn't pay attention to community organizing. And then they go, what the hell happened in Georgia, right? I don't know about you, but I knew that was happening in Georgia for some time because I've had a chance to talk to those organizers and be aware of the really amazing work that they were doing at a grassroots level, particularly Black women organizers, to be able to activate communities, build bridges, et cetera. So that's the story of the transformation of California. And they did three things, but I will focus on two right now because I mentioned one earlier. The one thing that they did was what we now call integrated voter engagement. You know, normally when people do voter engagement, they do something called get out the vote, GOTV. And what GOTV means that you go helicopter in some people, you have them go and knock the doors of people who vote a lot, and you try to make sure that they turn out. Of course, what's happening is that the other side does the same thing. And so you each turn out voters, and progressives don't win. What social movement activists did in California was integrated voter engagement, focused on new and occasional voters that didn't turn out. And knocking on those doors and understanding the trick was that you needed to do long-term, relational, one-on-one organizing to get them to engage in the act of voting. And also that voting is like a gateway drug to civic action. That is, it's legitimate. You know that if you vote, that's something you're supposed to be able to do. Well, maybe if you voted in this election after I organized you, you're going to be willing to go to a city council meeting or a school board meeting or an environmental hearing and work on issues of your community. So community organizing meets electoral politics that happened in California, and it was responsible for increasing taxes, responsible for passing criminal justice reform, and so many other things. And by the way, that's what won Arizona and Georgia in the last presidential election. And that's what, this is the other thing which I think is really important, that was connected with that politics I talked about, move the middle rather than moving to the middle. I could talk about California, but let me just talk about Georgia for a minute.
Which is a place I lived in until 2 years ago, so.
Oh my gosh, so
yeah,
you know it even better than I. But one of the things I think is really critical to realize is that if that last set of Senate races had been run by the typical Democratic Party strategy, they would have said, we should run Doug Jones or Joe Manchin, and they would have lost. Instead, there was an effort to change the electorate and move the middle rather than moving to the middle. And frankly, Reverend Warnock and John Ossoff are two of the most liberal senators in the Senate right now. So it's not just that you got a Democratic majority, you actually strengthened progressive forces through integrated voter engagement and moving the middle. And then the third thing I would say, and I think you saw this in Georgia as well, is intersectional organizing, which links together issues and communities. And as much credit is due and should be due, and I celebrate, to the Black community for its vote and for the organizing that took place in Georgia, Asian folks came along because they were
huge numbers.
Suburban whites were able to find a place in that electoral movement. Latino immigrants, small in number in terms of who could vote, but persuaded by a movement that was welcoming them and by Black leadership that was standing up for immigrants, right? So that, I think, there's so many lessons there around integrated voter engagement, moving the middle, and deep intersectional work that's not just coalitions, but standing in alliance over the long haul. Does that resonate with you in terms of the Georgia experience?
Absolutely. I mean, when I was living in Georgia, it was really interesting to be on the inside, sort of watching the framework that was being not only built, but then fleshed out, and seeing how much work went in for years ahead of those elections to get to a point where those elections were possible. I mean, it was a real education. It was really impressive. And I mean, all credit to the people there. They did some extraordinary work, and they're still doing the work. The election is over. They have not stopped. They are still doing the work. They're still building the coalitions. They're still on the ground, bringing new people in and doing everything they can to shore up that system and also oppose the voting restrictions that the legislature is trying to impose. So, yeah.
No, I mean, it's crucial because I think that what people traditionally think in political circles is that organizing is instrumental. That is, it's a way to win a campaign around an issue or to win an electoral campaign. And I think what the organizers in Georgia, Arizona, actually Ohio, the Ohio Organizing Collaborative, the new Virginia majority of this going on in Florida, and certainly in California, is realizing that organizing is fundamental, that it's about empowering people to be able to have a voice in their own lives, not just when they vote, but at every moment. And by making it fundamental, also transforming people to themselves be more empathetic and intersectional with other people's struggles. And so that's why a typical GOTV thing would basically roll up the tents at the end of the campaign. The New Georgia Project, while they may shrink in their staff size because it's not an election right now, is going to continue to do the organizing work along with groups like Georgia Stand Up and so many others, because they really want to maintain that leadership and that sense of empowerment between elections so that they can activate it more easily when an election comes, but that they can also activate it to oppose that kind of legislation. And one thing you're pointing to is that the right recognizes this and is basically trying to restrict the right to vote. because what they've recognized is not just the demographic change. That's the other thing about California. People think, well, there was demographic change, so as a result, the state changed. Demography is not destiny. I mean, you can see that by the fact that the share of Black men who voted for Trump actually went up. The share of Latinos who voted for Trump actually went up. Demography doesn't necessarily make you more progressive. It creates an opportunity to create a progressive mindset, to do the kind of organizing to change the nation, but you actually need to do the work. And that's full-time year-round.
Absolutely. I could have this conversation with you for the rest of today, but our time is coming to a close. And I would love it if you would leave our audience with three simple things that they can do to help replicate what California accomplished, what Georgia accomplished.
So the three things that I would say is, number one, stop thinking about California as a one-off. You know, I feel like you read the book with a completely open mind. There's often a sense in the rest of the country, California is really weird. They're super progressive. You know, we can't learn anything. And people, again, are forgetting that we give you Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, anti-tax fervor, xenophobic legislation, criminalization of Black and brown youth. I mean, we did all the bad shit. So the story of the arc of change in California for the people who are learning from it and then applying it to their local circumstances, because, you know, it's not one size fits all. But what can we learn from each other? You know, obviously, there's been some super creative work being done in Georgia and Arizona that we all need to learn about, too. So kind of don't think about California as a one-off. And what that means, I think, in complement, is wherever you are, change is possible. The second thing, to get back to something that we talked about, is learn to talk about race and racism every day in every conversation, looking for it so that you can get better at the conversation, that you can invite more people in so that your analysis sharpens up about that. And the third thing I would say is probably a pretty immediate thing to do is to continue to listen to this podcast, because I'm sure you're going to get a lot of really good ideas for your local organizing, and in particular for thinking about how we can build a big tent that is not a circus, but that is actually a coalition and alliance of different folks who understand that a world steeped in justice is a world that we want to build together.
Thank you. And thank you for the compliment. I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for this conversation. As I said before, I really loved your book. I have highlighted it within an inch of its life, and I will be recommending it to people for years, I'm quite sure. So thank you so much, Manuel. This was just wonderful.
Gracias. Ha sido un placer. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. So I do love this book. I love it not just for the history, which gave me context for some of the things I hadn't understood particularly well. I mostly love it because it gave me a roadmap that I can use in continuing my own work. It gave me things to consider in ways that I hadn't before, and that is going to save me time. Time that can be spent advancing the causes that are critical to me rather than reinventing the wheel. I hope that you also found yourself inspired to look at how you're doing what you're doing and see where you might make some tweaks. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back with another episode of Stepping into Truth very soon. And until then, remember that change starts with story, so keep sharing yours.